Yeah, we are back again. So Prabha, you wanted to comment on this independence of thinking. So please go ahead.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, when we talk about some of these great figures, whether it is Shankaracharya, Vivekananda, Ramana Maharshi, a lot of these people that we have canonized, even rishis and kind of ancient legends, oftentimes they rose to prominence because they provided a new interpretation, or they disagreed or challenged the prevailing ideas at the time. And Shankaracharya became so well known because he engaged in debates all throughout India with his contemporaries, and because he was challenging not only the status quo, but the other ideologies and ways of thinking at the time. And that is, you know, how we have all these records of his writings and teachings, is because of this dialogue that existed, these debates that existed. So I think even within the history of Hinduism, we have so many examples, rich examples of debates happening, and this idea that even the same spirit, the same ideas can be reformulated for each new generation, and within a new time and context, whether, you know, Shankaracharya in this kind of classical period, we have, you know, other figures like Vivekananda, who in this modern, new, emerging, independent India, kind of provided the same Vedanta philosophy in a new framework, and with that kind of new language for this new generation. And so I think that all of those figures, their prominence is a direct reflection of this long tradition of debate and discussion and reformulation of thought. There is a book that was really important and that I read probably in high school by Amartya Sen. Amartya Sen is well known as an economist and maybe less so as a philosopher, but there's a great book he has called The Argumentative Indian. And in that book, he talks about Indian intellectual history and the Indian civilization and the importance and the history of dialogue and debate in the Indian philosophical tradition and in the Indian intellectual tradition. And I mean, he's arguing that in a democratic society, you know, we debate things and we use dialogue to reach conclusions and to decide on policy. And he's arguing that India is suitable for democracy because India has one of the most ancient traditions of dialogue and debate. And he provides a lot of examples throughout Indian history and in Hindu philosophy for this type of dialogue and disagreement and how important it is to Hinduism.
So this is Amartya Sen, who is the Nobel laureate, economist?
That's right. That's right.
Okay, so can you tell us about indirect versus direct sources of knowledge? And then correspondingly, giving fish to somebody hungry, the famous adage, versus teaching how to fish. So you want to elaborate on those questions?
Yeah, definitely. I think that, you know, when we talk in the Hindu tradition about epistemology and about sources of knowledge and means of knowledge, we use the word pramana. And I think this is a really important concept, not just in a philosophical perspective or not just in a, you know, Vedanta perspective, but even more broadly, this idea of pramana, how somebody comes to know something, I think is a really valuable tool as an educator and as a student, and even from a, you know, marketing perspective almost, right? Because I think that, you know, just to give, you know, like a concrete, you know, unrelated modern example, if you are thinking about public health and you're thinking about, you know, encouraging people to maybe take the COVID vaccine, there are a lot of people who will respond differently to that same information or encouragement based on how it's presented. you know, there are people who, you know, if Harvard Medical School publishes a study, or if Science or Nature or, you know, the a top journal publishes a study, that is what will convince them. Then they will say, oh, okay, I trust this information. There are people who will say, my church leader or my imam or my priest or my pastor.
Swami.
Could be Pope, whoever, you know, he is recommending this or he is recommending against this. There are people who, you know, if Donald Trump says you should take the COVID vaccine, they will follow suit. And if he says don't take it, they don't take it maybe. And so at the same idea, I mean, the same message can, you know, be received by different people, and different people are amenable to learning about that in different ways. There are some kind of ways of communicating that resonate with some people and not with others. And so I think that, I think this idea of pramana, not just in the, you know, a deeper philosophical idea reason and intellect versus scriptural authority, but not just outside of that debate, but also in understanding how to teach somebody about Hinduism, I think it really helps to know that individual, that child, that student, and how it is that they learn. Because a certain type of explanation might be more appealing to one mind than a different type of explanation, which might be appealing to another mind. So I think that that is really important. And I think that ultimately, everyone reaches a certain point in their life when they will have to explore for themselves and make decisions for themselves and decide, you know, what is right and wrong, and kind of apply dharma in their own lives. And it's like you are saying at the end of the Gita, for example, right? Krishna says, okay, now it's up to you to apply this, to make your own decisions and apply these insights. And so I think that the way in which you teach about, teach Hinduism can really influence how somebody's journey and relationship with it, once they leave home, once they kind of leave a Balavihar environment or some kind of Gurukulam environment, and they go out for themselves to college or into the workforce, or because I think that there are certain things that you can teach. And if you emphasize, you know, memorization, or you emphasize, you know, reading from certain texts, then that will be the system by which they might, that might become their relationship with Hinduism. And if they rely on, you know, a parent or an elder to answer their questions, their growth may stop with the knowledge that that parent or elder has. So I think that a really important thing in thinking of how we educate young people is giving them the tools to ask the right questions and connecting them with the sources, the right sources of knowledge to get answers to those questions. And so, you know, I talked a little earlier about, you know, questioning and doubt and the idea that, oh, if you don't know something, you can direct them to an individual who might know the answer. But, you know, even more generally than that, the idea of, you know, in college, I took a Sanskrit class. Academically, I enrolled in a year, a few semesters of Sanskrit. And it's, I think that that did not make me a Sanskrit expert. It did not, I did not walk away from that being able to pick up any sukta or pick up any text and immediately be able to understand it. But what it really gave me was practice with being able to look up words that I don't know. It gave me the tools to take a text that I am not familiar with and be able to decompose it, be able to try to translate it on my own, to go through that exercise. So ultimately, I think that, you know, we learn a lot of things in school, like you know, in math and science. And, you know, right now, if you asked me to do a problem I learned in high school calculus, I might not be able to replicate the knowledge that I had, many years ago. But having been through that process, I can replicate how I learned that. And learning it the second time around will be much faster. And I will know how to learn that. And I think that that is the key. It's really teaching people how to get the answers to the questions they have. And I think that oftentimes when people get stuck or when they have questions and doubts, but they don't know where to direct them and they don't know how to resolve them, it can lead people to either give up or it can lead people to get frustrated. And so I think that that can either like stifle somebody's journey with Hinduism and with exploring the Dharma, but it can also turn people away completely altogether.
How true. Education is mostly about learning how to learn. Yes, wonderful. And then the last question I want to ask you is that in your view, what are the pros and cons of the fact that there is a lot of intellectual diversity in Hinduism? There are at least six schools of thought and many sub-schools, darshanas and so on. And this may be especially important for NRIs as to which branch of Hinduism, which particular darshana that they should concentrate on, and what is the effect of that on their journey?
Yeah, so I mean, some of these themes we touched on in some of the earlier questions. I mean, this theme of debate and dialogue and discussion, disagreement within the Hindu tradition, within Indian intellectual history. I think as a result of that, you have a lot of diversity, both in terms of how people interpret texts and the different, you know, schools of thought, a different Shad Darshanas, like you mentioned, as well as different expressions of the same thought. So even within the same school of thought, there are, you know, emphasis on bhakti or emphasis on service or, particular karmas or rituals could be more focus on jnana yoga, so much diversity in how Hinduism is practiced. And I think that that is one of the ultimately very beautiful things about Hinduism. And I think that that is also why it has survived and continues to thrive after so many thousands of years, where so many other religions have either, been replaced or have become transformed in some ways. I think Hinduism has this continuity that goes, that dates so far back because it allows for diversity and it allows for interpretation. And because the spirit of its themes are kind of always present. But I think that for somebody who is a student of Hinduism, a student of the Dharma, somebody who is seeking answers to questions, oftentimes it can be very confusing as well, because oftentimes it means that there might be multiple answers to a question, might be multiple different answers to a question. And it might be also that when you grow up, especially, in my case in the United States, you may only be exposed to a certain slice of Hinduism based on where you live and the community that is present in that area. In my case, I think I benefited a lot from the fact that both my parents individually have different approaches to Hinduism. And so they both have kind of different flavors, different preferences for how they engage with Dharma. And also we moved around a lot throughout the United States when I was, throughout my childhood. So, when I was born, my father was a professor and we lived in the Midwest. Later, he left academia, went into industry. We lived in New Jersey for a few years, lived in California for a few years. They later moved to Boston. So we had spent a lot of time in different areas. And as a result, I was also exposed to different types of communities. So, you know, when we lived in the Midwest, my mom at, you know, the group there, it was an SRF, Self-Realization Fellowship group. So she was part of a, you know, a group where, you know, they followed Paramahamsa Yogananda. And so she, you know, learned Kriya Yoga and read his books. And then when we moved to New Jersey, you know, in that area, there was a Chinmaya Mission and I attended Baal Vihar there. And, you know, in California, there was different groups. And, you know, later, you know, after college, you know, I lived in a place where the Ramakrishna Mission was the center that was nearby. And being exposed to all of those different centers, different groups, because each of them have a different flavor of Hinduism, it was able to give me this kind of, you know, more rich and diverse perspective also. Because I think that especially, you know, one of the challenges we have at Duke in kind of curating events for the Hindu students here is oftentimes people come, college students come for the first time, they're leaving home and they might want to continue their traditions. And one of the things that becomes very challenging here is that it's almost as if people speak different languages, because there are some students that, you know, they come from homes where they sing bhajans and that and they sing very well, and maybe they learned music. And there are other families where, you know, it was reading texts and it was Bhagavad Gita and I emphasis on maybe Upanishads or other scriptures. You know, there are families where festivals, Hindu festivals are more of a social gathering. And there are all sorts of different organizations, different emphases. And so I think that being exposed to different, you know, in, like I mentioned with my parents, you know, my mother has really delved deeper into in meditation. And she has become much more interested, you know, first in Advaita Vedanta, but also in yoga and meditation. And then, you know, that there's a big contrast between, you know, her and my dad. And my dad every day will wake up and, you know, he will do his puja every day. He has, you know, his own mandir and he will sit and he will chant and he will do a sankalpam every day. And so for him, the idea of maintaining that ritual practice is an essential part of how he practices. And so to be able to just see both of that, you know, that contrast, I think it was valuable for me. And I think that is something, because oftentimes, you know, there is a much bigger question of who is a Hindu or what is a Hindu? What does it mean to be religious? And, you know, I've seen in a lot of family, friends, and other people, the idea that, you know, there might be someone who is not very interested in, or religious. You know, I'm struck by this conversation where an auntie had asked me to talk to her daughter and basically said, you know, she's not really interested. And, you know, I thought maybe you could talk to her you know, maybe like inspire her and so on. And I had a conversation with her and I just asked, you know, what are you majoring in? What are you thinking of studying? And she said, okay, like I'm pre-med, but I, you know, I want to study cognitive science or psychology. I'm really interested in you know, the brain and how we think and how we perceive things. And ultimately, this conversation, which was prompted by her mom saying, oh, maybe you can inspire her to learn more about Hinduism or think about, you know, our culture. I ended up having an hour-long discussion with her about the Mandakya Upanishad. She didn't realize we were having a conversation about Mandakya Upanishad because, I mean, she might not have the language to talk about it that way. But, you know, I asked her, why are you interested in cognitive science? Why are you interested in psychology? And she talked to me about dreams. She talked to me about, oh, how do you know what's real? How do you perceive things? You know, when we talk about color, what does that mean? You know, do I see red the same as how you see red? And ultimately, you know, she's asking the same questions about what is Maya, what is real, what is Satya, what is Asatya, something that we experience, can we know it to be true? How do I know whether I am the perceiver? How do you distinguish between the perceived and the perceiver? I mean, all of these are fundamental questions that, you know, oftentimes we think, oh, it's, you know, too advanced for kids, right? Or we think that it's beyond what people are interested in. And in the reality is a lot of people who, you know, their parents might think, oh, they're not interested in Hinduism. It might just be because they have a different either learning style, they resonate with a different expression of Hinduism, or it might simply be that there is a language barrier. I mean, that the same concepts when presented in English without all of the trappings of devotion and culture and, you know, Sanskrit appeal to them in a way that it might not appeal to them if it's associated with getting up early in the morning to go to some Sunday school and have to, you know, get shunted by their parents or, you know, what have you. So I think that oftentimes, you know, a lot of Western movies that are very popular science fiction movies, they're really expressing the same types of themes that, you know, the Vedanta talks about. So I think that these ideas really resonate with people, whether they are Hindu or not, whether they are Indian or not, whether they are atheist, Christian, agnostic, whatever you want to call it. I think that, you know, every person asks at some point in their life, why was I born? Who am I? What is the meaning of life? Why am I here? What should I do? I mean, these are questions that inevitably every person asks. And I think that, you know, one of the ways that humans cope with that is just to keep yourself so busy that you don't have to face those questions. You distract yourself with, you know, consuming things or being busy enough that you don't let your mind wander there. Sometimes because those questions can be tough, right? And they can be hard, and thinking about those things, you know, can be like disheartening. And so sometimes we fill our lives with stuff to avoid those questions. But I think the mind naturally gravitates towards those questions. And I think part of the importance of religion and Hinduism in an individual's life is to provide a healthy avenue to handle those questions.
So yeah, that's a very, very good point that if you use the right language to communicate with the young ones, you will get to them. But yeah, this has been a fabulous conversation, fascinating one. And thank you very much, Prabhu, and Hari Om.
Hari Om, Dr. Veri.